We want to talk also only under the right conditions. Otherwise, we're not talking.
Trump further defines conditions for North Korea talks. It's Wednesday, February 28th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, South Korea seeks jail time for a former president. What's behind tense U.S.-Australian relations? How to find oil in contested waters? A mini pacemaker? And a new atomic clock? It's all on today's VOA Asia. Controversial North Korean general on Tuesday ended his visit to South Korea, part of a North Korean delegation sent to take part in the closing ceremonies of the Winter Olympic Games. Kim Jong-chol, suspected of masterminding 2010 attacks that killed dozens of South Koreans, reportedly twice indicated a willingness by Pyongyang to engage in dialogue with the United States. The U.S. has indicated talks must include the North's denuclearization. President Donald Trump, in remarks to the nation's governors on Monday at the White House, said the U.S. is prepared for dialogue.
We want to talk also only under the right conditions. Otherwise, we're not talking. You know, they've been talking for 25 years. Other presidents should have solved this problem long before I got here. And they've been talking for 25 years. And you know what happened? Nothing. The Clinton administration spent billions and billions of dollars. They gave them billions. They built things for them. They went out of their way, and the day after the agreement was signed, they continued with nuclear research. The Bush administration did nothing, both. The Obama administration wanted to do something. He told me it's the single biggest problem that this country has. But they didn't do anything. And it would have been much easier in those days than it is now. I think most people understand that. China's been good, but they haven't been great. China has really done more probably than they've ever done because of my relationship. We have a very good relationship. And Russia is behaving badly because Russia is sending in what China is taking out.
On Friday, the Trump administration unveiled tough new sanctions on the North over its nuclear and missile programs. Mr. Trump, in his remarks Monday, warned darkly of a phase two if the sanctions don't work. He said in a war, there would be a, quote, tremendous potential loss of lives. Henry Kazianis is director of defense studies at the Washington-based Center for the National Interest. VOA's Victor Beatty asked what Mr. Trump means by talking under the right conditions.
What that means is that the Trump administration, I think, has been signaling for a little while now that the only way that they are going to negotiate with North Korea is if the North Koreans are serious about denuclearization. There's been quite a few comments from Mike Pence and others that they're willing as an initial step to talk to the North Koreans, but that they're not going to give anything up for just the simple pleasure of talking with them. They want to move very quickly from, you know, talks and getting to know one another to negotiations over their nuclear program. I've heard from many White House officials at this point over the last week, week and a half or so, that they're willing to talk to the North Koreans, but if the talks don't move quickly to some sort of talk about denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, they will walk away from those talks. That's what the president was referring to.
Mr. Trump, in speaking to the governors, praised China's President Xi Jinping for bolstering his country's sanctions against the North, but warned that Russia is, quote, behaving badly on the issue. Quote, Russia is sending in what China is taking out.
Well, the Russians have been caught on a few occasions now doing what are called ship-to-ship transfers of what we think is oil. There have been pictures that have been circulated on the Internet, quite a few open-source reports. That actually goes back to late December. And it actually, it's sort of strange, Russia has been one of the ones at the UN Security Council resolution that signed on for oil sanctions against North Korea. And it seems like Moscow is one of the ones that is actually violating the sanctions. Now, we don't know if this is something that the Putin government has actually sanctioned or if this is independent Russian entities that are basically trying to make some fast profits, you know, cashing in where Beijing, you know, isn't selling them oil anymore. So these are some of the things we're going to have to find out. But that seems like what Trump was referring to.
The North Korean delegation during the closing ceremonies of the Winter Olympics in South Korea indicated that the North twice would be willing to engage in dialogue with the U.S. Knowing the U.S. position, why would they advance that?
There's a few theories that have been postulated. I think the one that makes the most sense is this is right out of the North Korean playbook. It's a play for time. We have to remember the North Koreans have not tested an ICBM or a long-range missile since November. I would theorize that the North Koreans are probably pulling together all the data of the two other ICBM tests they did in July, and they're trying to solve one big problem. How do you get those North Korean missiles to basically go through the atmosphere and hit a target? That's the last part that they need to be able to hit the United States with a nuclear weapon. So I think they're using this Olympic detente, if you will, to get to that last part of the puzzle. And I think it gives them, you know, a little bit of opportunity to string some of these talks along. But I don't think the Trump administration is going to fall into that trap.
Harry Kazianis said he believes South Korea views its role as facilitating talks that might eventually reach a stage where the North might make concessions on its nuclear program. He said there are still some weeks before the end of the Paralympics in South Korea and the resumption of joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises, and they will be crucial in determining how committed the North is to its latest charm offensive. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. South Korea urges U.S. support for North Korea nuclear talks. U.S. cutting aid to Cambodia for recent democratic setbacks. Sri Lanka shops and mosque damaged in Buddhist-Muslim clash. The word disagree banned on China's social media. U.S. adds several Islamic State affiliates to terror list. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more will be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. Stop by there when you can, and also visit our VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. South Korean prosecutors are seeking a 30-year prison term for disgraced former President Park Geun-hye, who was impeached in 2016 and removed from office last year on corruption charges. The 66-year-old daughter of former dictator Park Chung-hee also faces tens of millions in fines. Park allegedly, in collusion with longtime friend Choi Soon-sil, took or was promised bribes from three South Korean companies in return for policy favors. She is also accused of coercing several large firms to donate to foundations controlled by Choi. The former president has denied wrongdoing. James Kim, research fellow at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies, tells VOA the length of the recommended prison term is not surprising to him.
Over the past 2 weeks or so, the court has been leveling charges against other key individuals involved in this particular scandal. And one of those accused and convicted was Ms. Choi, who was sentenced to 25 years. So everybody knew and expected President Park to at least get the same amount of penalty in terms of number of years of prison sentence or even more. So this was not at all a big surprise. She's accused of engaging in bribery, using her position to get different companies and conglomerates to pay essentially a political donation to companies that Ms. Choi has been safekeeping for, supposedly, allegedly, for President Park in part.
Kim says the political journey of Park Geun-hye has had incredible heights, from winning election by more than a million votes in 2012 to the current prosecution against her.
It has been a roller coaster ride for Korean politics in Seoul here. A lot of people have watched this very closely. As you know, a large number of people turned out to protest against President Park to get the impeachment proceeding through for her to be removed from office. And that's exactly what happened last year and ushered in a new era with President Moon being elected several months earlier than was expected.
The case has brought to light cozy political ties that South Korea's top politicians have had with huge conglomerate companies, which James Kim says seems to continue to be a problem.
It's continued to be a vexing social and political issue for South Korea ever since the early development years, when the state was integrally involved in nurturing these conglomerates. When there were developing companies during the 70s and the 60s. A lot of these companies have done well but they've maintained that close tie throughout these years. And it's been very difficult for administrations from both the conservative and the progressive parties to break that tie.
Sentencing is expected within the month. James Kim said typically a former president is pardoned by a succeeding administration, but President Moon Jae-in has indicated he will not use his powers to pardon Park. Happening now in Asia, North Korea will follow its recent Winter Olympic presence with a trimmed-down delegation attending the Paralympic Games in South Korea. The agreement came at a working-level meeting at the Truce Village of Panmunjom on Tuesday. The Pyeongchang Paralympics begin March 9th. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. You've reached Wednesday, and we're glad that you're here with us on VOA Asia. President Donald Trump and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull met this past weekend at the White House here in Washington. It was a very short meeting amid tensions between the two leaders on a few key issues, including dealing with China. VOA Asia's Ira Melman discussed these points in depth with Josh Kurlansik, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations.
China and Australia are really close economic partners, and that's probably not unlikely to change. There are problems in terms of Australian intelligence and security concerns about Chinese purchases of some potentially security-sensitive companies. There are concerns about the opaque structure and corporate governance of some Chinese companies that have made investments in Australia, but the trade relationship is enormous, and it's going to continue to be so. More what the concern about is in the Australian security and intelligence community is that Chinese government is pursuing an approach of wielding more than just soft power, where you just try to sort of shape people's views, but actively trying to wield influence within Australian politics in ways that probably they shouldn't, which is why Australia has drafted new laws on foreign funding and similar to the Foreign Agents Registration Act that we have here.
What do you expect to be the toughest negotiating points for either leader?
Turnbull is not going to change the U.S. this administration's view on trade, and that's a pretty bitter pill. Australia has for decades now identified itself with the U.S. in the security realm, but is increasingly, you know, tied into and central to trade networks in Asia. And Turnbull and Australian officials are going to keep pushing throughout Trump's term that the U.S. needs to get re-involved in trade, but I just don't see how that's going to happen.
And what about Trump?
So Trump has a concern. This is what sparked the unpleasant exchange, supposedly, in their call. Trump doesn't like the fact that the Obama administration reached a deal with Australia to resettle a small number of refugees who are being held in the third country from Australia. Trump has vowed to uphold this deal, but he keeps complaining about it, and that was part of what he complained about to Turnbull, and he didn't want to hear about it. I think that they're going to uphold the deal, but that's going to be very unpleasant because he seems to really dislike this deal. It's a very small number of people. But in terms of the other broader aspects, Turnbull is a conservative in the sort of Australian sense, but his views on many, many issues are still considerably to the left of what a conservative in the United States would be. So there's not going to be much discussion of many of the issues that sort of animate domestic politics in the United States, simply because they're not even that relevant in Australia. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Trump continues to be upset about the fact that the U.S. has agreed to take a certain number of refugees from Australia, or not from Australia, but from a third country that Australia is trying to resettle them from. Australia is engaging in a very substantial intra-Australian debate in the public and in politics there about really the long-term future of Australia's relationship with the U.S. and whether it can continue that and closer relationship with China. And so it would be interesting to watch how that plays out in this visit and played out in this visit and in the future. Trump has sort of accelerated this discussion in Australian policy circles about whether Australia should be less dependent on the U.S.
Josh Kurlansik, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Emergency response crews in Papua New Guinea are assessing damage and confirming casualties from a powerful earthquake that reportedly killed more than a dozen people. A 7.5 magnitude quake struck Monday, knocking down power lines and damaging roads on the small Pacific island. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a South Korean firm's uncontested discovery of oil in a sea where six other governments vie for sovereignty shows how outsiders harvest maritime resources without adding to decades of political friction. South Korean petroleum refining company SK Innovation Company said last week it had found crude oil at a Chinese tract in the South China Sea. Its case shows that firms from countries with no political stake in the resource-rich South China Sea can find oil and natural gas by contracting with one of the claimant's governments. Analysts like Oh Ae Sun, international studies instructor at Singapore Nanyang University, say those governments normally rent out blocks in their 370-kilometer-wide exclusive economic zones rather than further out at sea where conflict is more likely.
This is not uncommon, but of course, whenever there's a discovery, people would raise their eyebrows, especially nowadays. These various claims to South China Sea territories and seabeds has been intensifying.
Six governments claim the 3.5 million square kilometer sea that stretches from Taiwan to Singapore. They are Brunei, China, Malaysia, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam. Their disputes rest partly on control of undersea oil and gas. The U.S. Energy Information Agency estimates 11 billion barrels worth of oil under the sea exist, along with 190 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. China claims about 90% of the waters, but India and Spain have worked with Vietnam since 2016 to find fuel under the seabed. The Philippines was working with U.S.-based Forum Energy in 2012 to explore for the same. In 2014, Shell and a Malaysian partner found natural gas. Alan Chong, associate professor at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore, says countries with South China Sea claims are quietly setting aside politics to make the most of a globalized oil economy, sometimes through joint ventures.
The complicity is just tangled. Indirectly, someone benefits along the way, even though officially the governments be at loggerheads. Much as the governments are officially drawing the line around recognizing Chinese claims, privately, I think they've just closed an eye to all these subterranean corporate linkages.
He and other analysts say most fuel exploration contracts involving outside companies take place when a claimant country offers a block of the ocean to outside bids. They add that oil companies may not mind the political risk as they're used to projects in the politically volatile Middle East. Their main fear is the prospect of finding no fuel under the sea after spending billions of dollars. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei. This news alert from VOA Asia. Authorities in China have launched an intense crackdown on online commentary in the wake of a proposal by the country's Communist Party leaders to amend the constitution and scrap a two-term limit on the president's time in office. A wide range of phrases in Chinese have been banned to silence public debate. Freely available is VOA Asia Facebook. This story and more you'll find there. This is VOA Asia. Now in VOA Asia, some new tiny pacemakers are making headway around the world. One type is keeping 15,000 people's hearts beating in 40 countries, according to the manufacturer. Studies show these small pacemakers are safe, and as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, doctors expect the technology will help more heart patients over time.
A healthy heart has its own pacemaker that establishes its rhythm, but some people, like Mary Lou Trejo, need the help of an artificial pacemaker.
My heart does not beat regularly. It skips beats, and sometimes it's normal, and then all of a sudden it just goes out of rhythm.
At Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Trejo became one of the first patients in the United States to have a pacemaker that's only 24 millimeters long implanted in her heart. This device is one-tenth the size of traditional pacemakers. Most pacemakers rely on batteries placed under the skin. They use wire leads with electrodes on one end that are threaded through blood vessels to connect to the heart. Dr. Ralph Augustini at Ohio State says this tiny pacemaker simplifies that.
The electrodes are part of the can, and therefore it eliminates the lead.
Augustini implanted Trejo's pacemaker as part of a clinical trial in 2014. He threaded the entire device through an artery in her leg up to the heart. Cardiologist John Hummel has studied the effectiveness of this new generation of pacemakers.
We don't leave any wires behind, and the pacemaker, the battery, the wire is all just a tiny little piece of metal sitting down in the heart.
There's no surgery involved, so the entire process is safer, according to studies on the Microbrand, which Trejo had implanted, and another type made by St. Jude Medical. Dr. Richard Wechter has implanted the Micra in patients at the University of Missouri Hospital.
The complication rates in general for a leadless pacemaker to date have been about half what a traditional percutaneous pacemaker would have.
The battery on this pacemaker can last for 14 years. After that, doctors can implant another one into the same chamber of the heart and repeat it a third time if needed. Doctors have called these devices revolutionary. As for Mary Lou Trejo, 4 years after her surgery, her doctors say she is doing just fine. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Only days after the spectacular liftoff of what is currently the heaviest space rocket, the privately built Falcon Heavy, NASA announced the next launch will carry a specially built atomic clock. VOA's George Pudich reports the new device, much smaller and sturdier than Earthbound atomic clocks, will help future astronauts navigate in deep space.
Even SpaceX CEO Elon Musk was not sure the Falcon Heavy's first flight would go as smoothly as it did.
I didn't really think this would work. When I see the rocket lift off, I see like a thousand things that could not work, and it's amazing when they do.
The Falcon Heavy's 27 rocket engines can carry as much as 64 tons of payload way beyond the low Earth orbit, where the International Space Station and most satellites circle our planet. Its next launch is scheduled for June, and it is not yet known what its payload will be, except for one piece of cutting-edge technology, the new deep space atomic clock built by NASA. It is now undergoing tests at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. John Lowe is a scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which also builds atomic clocks.
Time is distance. And so if you have an atomic clock in space, it's an aid to your navigational process. And so the better the clock, the better you can use it for your navigation.
According to NASA, the deep space atomic clock is expected to lose not more than 7 millionths of a second during a decade. Smaller than a microwave oven, it is specially built for harsh space environment. Earthbound atomic clocks precisely measure how long it takes for a radio signal to travel between the Earth and the spacecraft. This allows ground controllers to tell astronauts where they are and where to go next. An atomic clock positioned closer to their spaceship will help astronauts navigate without having to wait for signals from the Earth.
I think pretty much every deep space mission will probably have an atomic clock on it from here on out.
NASA engineers say in the future they will build even smaller space atomic clocks that could also help improve the satellite-based global positioning system. George Pudich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us on iTunes and SoundCloud online, as well as streaming each day on VOA Asia Facebook and our website at voanews.com. You'll find us, too, on the radio if you happen to be out and about around Asia. How about Thailand? PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University. Thanks to everyone there listening today. Our thanks, as always, go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a great day.